Rings of theorems she'd never heard and titles of books she needed to finish by the end of the week. Combat class kept their bodies exhausted along with their minds. June put them through a torturous series of calisthenics. They regularly ran up the academy stairs and back down, did handstands in the courtyard for hours on end, and cycled through basic martial arts forms with bags of bricks hanging from their arms. Every week, June took them to a lake at the bottom of the mountain and had them swim the entire length. Rin and a handful of other students had never been taught to swim. June demonstrated the proper form exactly once. After that, it was up to them not to drown. Their homework was heavy and clearly meant to push the first years right up against their limits. So when the weapons master, Sonnen, taught them the correct proportions of saltpeter, sulfur, and charcoal necessary to mix the incendiary fire powder that powered war rockets, he also had them create their own impromptu missiles. And when the medicine master, Enro, assigned them to learn the names of all the bones in the human body, she also expected them to know the most common patterns of breakage and how to identify them. It was strategy, though, taught by Master Irja, that was their hardest course. Their first day of class he distributed a thick tome, Sunzi's Principles of War, and announced that they were to have it memorized by the end of the week.
"Well, this thing is massive," Han complained. "How are we supposed to do the rest of our homework?"
"Ultan Trengson learned it in a night," said Irja.
The class exchanged exasperated looks. The masters had been singing the praises of Ultan Trengson since the start of their term. Rin gathered he was some kind of genius, apparently the most brilliant student to come through Synegard in decades. Han looked as irritated as she felt.
"Okay, but we're not Ultan."
"Then try to be," said Irja. "Class dismissed."
Rin settled into a routine of constant study and very little sleep. Their course schedules left the first years with no time to do anything else. Autumn had just started to bite at Synegard. A cold gust of wind accompanied them as they raced up the steps one morning. It rustled through the trees in a thunderous crescendo. The pupils had not yet received their thicker winter robes, and their teeth chattered in unison as they huddled together under a large mimosa tree at the far end of the second-tier courtyard. Despite the cold, June refused to move combat class indoors before the snowfall made it impossible to hold outside. He was a brutal teacher who seemed to delight in their discomfort.
"Pain is good for you,"
he said as he forced them to crouch in low, torturous endurance stances.
"The martial artists of old used to hold this position for an hour straight before training."
"The martial artists of old must have had amazing thighs,"
Kitai gasped. Their morning calisthenics were still miserable, but at least they had finally moved past fundamentals to their first weapon-based arts. Staff techniques. Jun had just assumed his position at the fore of the courtyard when a loud shuffle sounded above his head. A smattering of leaves fell down right over where he stood. Everyone glanced up. Perched high up on a thick branch of the mimosa tree stood their long-absent lore master. He wielded a large pair of gardening shears, cheerfully clipping leaves at random while singing an off-key melody loudly to himself. After hearing a few words of the song, Rin recognized it as the Gatekeeper's Touches. Rin knew it from her many trips delivering opium to Takani's whorehouses. It was an obscene ditty bordering on erotica. The lore master butchered the tune, but he sang it aloud with wild abandon.
"I can't touch you there, miss, else you'll perish from the bliss."
Niang shook with suppressed giggles. Kitai's jaw hung wide open as he stared at the tree.
"Jung, I've got a class,"
Jun snapped.
"So teach your class," said Master Jung. "Leave me alone."
"We need the courtyard."
"You don't need all of the courtyard. You don't need this tree," Jung said petulantly.
Jun whipped his iron staff through the air several times and slammed it against the base of the tree. The trunk actually shook from the impact. There was the crackling noise of dead weight dropping through several layers of dry mimosa leaves. Master Jiang landed in a crumpled heap on the stone floor. Rin's first thought was that he wasn't wearing a shirt. Her second thought was that he must be dead. But Jiang simply rolled to a sitting position, shook out his left leg, and brushed his white hair back past his shoulders.
"That was rude," he said dreamily as blood trickled down his left temple.
"Must you bumble around like a lackwit?"
Jun snapped.
"Must you interrupt my morning gardening session?"
Jiang responded.
"You're not doing any gardening," Jun said. "You're here purely to annoy me."
"I think you're flattering yourself."
Jun slammed his staff on the ground, making Jiang jump in surprise.
"Out!"
Jiang adopted a dramatically wounded expression and hauled himself up to his feet. He flounced out of the garden, swaying his hips like a whorehouse dancer.
"If for me your heart aches, I'll lick you like a mooncake."
"You're right," Kitai whispered to Rin. "He has been getting high."
"Attention!"
Jun shouted at the gawking class. He still had a mimosa leaf stuck in his hair. It quivered every time he spoke. The class hastily lined up in two rows before him, staves at the ready.
"When I give the signal, you will repeat the following sequence."
He demonstrated with his staff as he spoke.
"Forward, back, upper left parry, return, upper right parry, return, lower left parry, return, lower right parry, return, spin, pass through the back, return. Understood?"
They nodded mutely. No one dared admit that they had missed nearly the entire sequence. Jun's demonstrations were usually rapid, but he had moved faster just now than any of them could follow.
"Well then,"
Jun slammed his staff against the floor.
"Begin!"
It was a fiasco. They moved with no rhythm or purpose. Naja blazed through the sequence at twice the speed of the rest of the class, but he was one of the only students who was able to do it at all. The rest of them either omitted half the sequence or badly mangled the directions.
"Ow!"
Kitai, parrying where he should have turned, hit Rin in the back. She jerked forward, knocking Venka in the head by accident.
"Stop!"
Jun shouted. Their flailing subsided.
"I'm going to tell you a story about the great strategist Sun Tzu."
Jun paced along their ranks, breathing heavily.
"When Sun Tzu finished writing his great treatise, Principles of War, he submitted the chapters to the Red Emperor. The Emperor decided to test Sun Tzu's wisdom by having him train a group of people with no military experience. The Emperor's concubines. Sun Tzu agreed and assembled the women outside the palace gates. He told them, 'When I say eyes front, you will look straight ahead. When I say left turn, you will face your left. When I say right turn, you must face your right. When I say about turn, you must turn 180 degrees. Is that clear?' The women nodded. Sun Tzu then gave the signal, 'Right turn.' But the women only burst out laughing."
Jun paused in front of Niang, whose face was pinched in trepidation.
"Sun Tzu told the Emperor, 'If words of command are not clear and distinct, if orders are not thoroughly understood, then the general is to blame.' So he turned to the concubines and repeated his instructions. 'Right turn,' he commanded. Again, the women fell about laughing."
Jun swiveled his head slowly, making eye contact with each one of them.
"This time, Sun Tzu told the Emperor, 'If words of command are not clear, then the general is to blame. But if words of command are clear, but orders are not executed, then the troop leaders are to blame.' Then he selected the two most senior concubines in the group and had them beheaded."
Niang's eyes looked like they were going to pop out of her head. Jun stalked back to the front of the courtyard and raised his staff. While they watched, terrified, Jun repeated the sequence, slowly this time, calling out the moves as he performed them.
"Was that clear?"
They nodded. He slammed his staff against the floor.
Then begin!
They drilled. They were flawless. Combat was a soul-sucking, spirit-crushing ordeal, but there was at least the fun of nightly practice sessions. These were guided drill periods supervised by two of June's apprentices, Kirill and Jiha. The apprentices were somewhat lazy teachers, and disproportionately enthused at the prospect of inflicting as much pain as possible on imagined opponents. As such, drill periods usually bordered on disaster, with Jiha and Kirill milling around, shouting bits of advice while the pupils sparred against one another.
"Unless you've got a weapon, don't aim for the face."
Jiha guided Venka's hand down so her extended knife hand strike would land on Nijah's throat rather than his nose.
"Aside from the nose, the face is practically all made of bone. You'll only bruise your hand. The neck's a better target. With enough force, you could fatally collapse the windpipe. At the very least, you'll give him breathing trouble."
Kirill knelt down next to Kitai and Han, who were rolling around on the ground in mutual headlocks.
"Fighting is an excellent technique if you're in a tight spot."
A moment later, Han shrieked in pain. A handful of first years clustered around a wooden dummy as Jiha demonstrated a proper knife hand strike.
"Nikata monks used to believe this point was a major key center."
Jiha indicated a spot under the dummy's stomach and punched it dramatically. Rin took the bait to speed things along.
"Is it?" "Nah. No such thing as key centers. But this area below the ribcage has a ton of necessary organs that are exposed. Also, it's where your diaphragm is."
"Ha!"
Jiha slammed his fist into the dummy.
"That should immobilize any opponent for a good few seconds. Gives you time to scratch out their eyes."
"That seems vulgar," said Rin. Jiha shrugged.
"We aren't here to be sophisticated. We're here to fuck people up."
"I'll show you all one last blow,"
Kirill announced as the session drew to a close.
"This is the only kick you'll ever need, really. A kick to bring down the most powerful warriors."
Jiha blinked in confusion. He turned his head to ask her what she meant. And Kirill raised her knee and jammed the ball of her foot into Jiha's groin. Mandatory drill sessions lasted for only 2 hours, but the first years began staying in the studio to practice their forms long after the period had ended. The only problem was that the students with previous training seized this chance to show off. Nadja performed a series of twirling leaps in the center of the room, attempting spinning kicks that became progressively more flamboyant. A small ring of his classmates gathered around to watch.
"Admiring our prince?"
Kitai strolled across the room to stand next to Rin.
"I fail to see how this would be useful in battle,"
Rin said. Nadja was now spinning a full 540 degrees in the air before kicking. It looked very pretty, but also very pointless.
"Oh, it's not. A lot of old arts are like that. Cool to watch, practically useless. The lineages were adapted for stage opera, not combat, and then adapted back. That's where the Red Junk Opera got their name, you know. The founding members were martial artists posing as street performers to get closer to their targets. You should read the history of inherited art sometime. It's fascinating."
"Is there anything you haven't read about?"
Rin asked. Kitai seemed to have an encyclopedic knowledge of almost every topic. That day over lunch, he had given Rin a lecture on how fish-gutting techniques differed across provinces.
"I have a soft spot for martial arts," said Kitai. "Anyway, it's depressing when you see people who can't tell the difference between self-defense and performance art."
Nadja landed, crouched impressively, after a particularly high leap. Several of their classmates, absurdly, began to clap. Nadja straightened up, ignoring the applause, and caught Rin's eye.
"That's what family arts are,"
he said, wiping the sweat off his forehead.
"I'm sure you'll be the terror of the school," said Rin. "You can dance for donations. I'll toss you an ingot."
A sneer twisted Najah's face.
"You're just jealous you have no inherited arts."
"I'm glad I don't, if they all look as absurd as yours."
"The House of Yin innovated the most powerful kicking-based technique in the Empire,"
Najah snapped.
"Let's see how you'd like being on the receiving end."
I think I'd be fine, Rin said, though it would be a dazzling visual spectacle.
At least I'm not an artless peasant, Najah spat. You've never done martial arts before in your life. You only know one kick.
And you keep calling me a peasant. It's like you only know one insult.
Duel me then, Najah said. Fight to incapacitation for 10 seconds or first blood. Right here, right now.
You're wrong, Rin started to say, but Kitai slapped a hand over her mouth.
Oh, no. Oh, no, no.
Kitai yanked Rin back.
You heard Jun. You shouldn't...
But Rin shrugged Kitai off.
Jun's not here, is he?
Najah grinned nastily.
Venka! Get over here!
Venka broke off her conversation with Nyang at the other end of the room and flounced over, flushed at Najah's summons.
Referee us,
Najah said, not taking his eyes off Rin. Venka folded her hands behind her back, imitating Master Jun, and lifted her chin.
Begin!
The rest of their class had now formed a circle around Najah and Rin. Rin was too angry to notice their stares. She had eyes only for Najah. He began moving around her, darting back and forth with quick, elegant movements. Kitai was right, Rin thought. Najah really did look like he was performing stage opera. He didn't seem particularly lethal then, just foolish. She narrowed her eyes and crouched low, following Najah's movements carefully. There, a clear opening. Rin raised a leg and kicked out, hard. Her leg caught Najah in midair with a satisfying woof. Najah uttered an unnatural shriek and clutched his crotch, whimpering. The entire studio fell silent as all heads swiveled in their direction. Najah clambered to his feet, scarlet-faced.
You! How dare you!
Just as you said. Rin dipped her head into a mocking bow. I only know one kick. Humiliating Najah felt good, but the political repercussions were immediate and brutal. It didn't take long for their class to form alliances. Najah, mortally offended, made it clear that associating with Rin meant social alienation. He pointedly refused to speak to her or acknowledge her existence, unless it was to make snide comments about her accent. One by one, the members of their class, terrified of receiving the same treatment, followed suit. Kitai was the one exception. He had grown up on Najah's bad side, he told Rin, and it wasn't about to start bothering him now.
Besides, he said, that look on his face! Priceless!
Rin was grateful for Kitai's loyalty, but was amazed by how cruel the other students could be. There was apparently no end of things about Rin to be mocked. Her dark skin, her lack of status, her country accent. It was annoying, but Rin was able to brush the taunts off, until her classmates started snickering every time she talked.
Is my accent so obvious? She asked Kitai.
It's getting better, he said. Just try rolling the ends of your words more. Shorten your vowels, and add the R sound where it doesn't exist. That's a good rule of thumb.
R. R.
Rin gagged.
Why do Synegardians have to sound like they're chewing cud?
Power dictates acceptability,
Kitai mused.
If the capital had been built in Takani, I'm sure we'd be running around dark as wood bark.
In the following days, Najah didn't utter a single word to her. Because he didn't have to. His adoring followers wasted no opportunity to mock Rin. Najah's manipulations turned out to be brilliant. Once he established that Rin was the prime target, he could just sit back and watch. Venka, who was obsessively attached to Najah, actively snubbed Rin whenever she had the chance. Nyang was better. She wouldn't associate with Rin in public, but she at least spoke to her in the privacy of their dorm.
You could try apologizing,
Nyang whispered one night after Venka had gone to sleep. Apologizing was the last thing Rin had in mind. She wasn't about to concede defeat by massaging Najah's ego.
It was his idea to duel, she snapped. It's not my fault he got what he was asking for.
Doesn't matter,
Niang said.
Just say you're sorry, and then he'll forget about you. Nudja just likes to be respected.
For what? Rin demanded. He hasn't done anything to earn my respect. All he's done is act high and mighty, like being from Synegard makes him so special.
Apologizing won't help,
interjected Venka, who apparently hadn't been asleep after all.
And being from Synegard does make us special. Nudja and I...
It was always Nudja and I with Venka.
Have trained for the academy since we could walk. It's in our blood. It's our destiny. But you? You're nothing. You're just some tramp from the south. You shouldn't even be here.
Rin sat up straight in her bed, suddenly hot with anger.
I took the same test as you, Venka. I have every right to be at this school.
You're just here to fill out the quota,
Venka retorted.
I mean, the kaju has to seem fair.
Annoying as Venka was, Rin scarcely had the time or energy to pay much attention to her. They stopped snapping at each other after several days, but only because they were too exhausted to speak. When training sessions ended for the week, they straggled back to the dormitory, muscles aching so much they could barely walk. Without a word, they shed their uniforms and collapsed on their bunks. They awoke almost immediately to a rapping at their door.
Get up, said Rabban when Rin yanked the door open.
What the?
Rabban peered over her shoulder at Venka and Niang, who were whining incoherently from their bunks.
You two, hurry up.
What's the matter?
Rin mumbled grumpily, rubbing at her eyes.
We've got sweeping duty in 6 hours.
Just come.
Still complaining, the girls wriggled into their tunics and met Rabban outside, where the boys had already assembled.
If this is some sort of first-year hazing thing, can I have permission to go back to bed?
Asked Katai.
Consider me bullied and intimidated. Just let me sleep. Shut up. Follow me.
Without another word, Rabban took off toward the forest. They were forced to jog to keep up with him. At first, Rin thought he was taking them deep into the mountainside forest, but it was only a shortcut. After a minute, they emerged in front of the main training hall. It was lit up from within, and they could hear loud voices from inside.
More class?
Asked Katai.
Great tortoise, I'm going on strike.
This isn't class.
For some reason, Rabban sounded very excited.
Get inside.
Despite the audible shouting, the hall was empty. Their class bumbled around in groggy confusion until Rabban motioned for them to follow him down the stairs to the basement floor. The basement was filled with apprentices crowded around the center of the room. Whatever stood at the center of attention, it sounded extremely exciting. Rin craned to get a glimpse over the apprentices' heads but could see nothing but bodies.
First year's coming through!
Rabban yelled, leading their little group into the packed crowd. Through vigorous use of elbows, Rabban carved them a path through the apprentices. The spectacle at the center was two circular pits dug deep into the ground, each at least 3 meters in diameter and 2 meters deep. The pits stood adjacent to one another, and were ringed with waist-high metal bars to keep spectators from falling in. One pit was empty. Master Sonnen stood in the center of the other, arms folded across his broad chest.
Sonnen always referees, Rabban said. He gets the short straw because he's the youngest.
Referees what?
Kitai asked. Rabban grinned widely. The basement door opened. Even more apprentices began to stream inside, filling the already cramped hall to the brim. The press of bodies forced the first years perilously close to the edges of the rings. Rin clenched the rail to keep from falling in.
What's going on?
Kitai asked as the apprentices jostled for positions closer to the rings. There were so many people in the room now that apprentices in the back had brought stools on which to stand.
Alton's up tonight, Raban said. Nobody wants to miss Alton.
It must have been the 12th time that week Rin had heard that name. The whole academy seemed obsessed with him. Fifth-year student Alton Trengzin was associated with every school record, was every master's favorite student, the exception to every rule. He had now become a running joke within their class. "Can you piss over the wall into town? Alton can." A tall, lithe figure suddenly dropped into Master Sonnen's ring without bothering to use the rope ladder. As his opponent scrambled down, the figure stretched his arms behind his back, head tilted up toward the ceiling. His eyes caught the reflection of the lamplight above. They were crimson.
"Great tortoise," said Kitai. "That's a real Spearly."
Rin peered inside the pit. Kitai was right. Alton didn't look close to Nikara. His skin was several shades darker than any of the other students, a darker hue even than Rin's. But where Rin's sun-browned skin made her look coarse and unsophisticated, Alton's skin gave him a unique, regal air. His hair was the color of wet ink, closer to violet than black. His face was angular, expressionless, and startlingly handsome. And those eyes, scarlet, blazing red.
"I thought the Spearlies were dead," said Rin.
"Mostly dead," said Raban. "Alton's the last one."
"I am Boa Coben, apprentice to Master Jun Loran," announced his opponent. "I challenge Alton Trengzin to a fight to incapacitation."
Coben had to be twice Alton's weight and several inches taller, yet Rin suspected this would not be a particularly close fight. Alton shrugged noncommittally. Sonnen looked bored.
"Well, go on," he said.
The apprentices fell into their opening stances.
"What? No introduction?"
Kitai asked. Raban looked amused. "Alton doesn't need an introduction." Rin wrinkled her nose. "He's a little full of himself, isn't he?"
"Alton Trengzin," Kitai mused. "Is Alton the clan name?"
"Trengzin. The Spearlies put clan names last," Raban explained hastily. He pointed to the ring.
"Shush, you'll miss it."
They already had. She hadn't heard Alton move, hadn't even seen the scuffle begin. But when she looked back down at the ring, she saw Coben pinned against the ground, one arm twisted unnaturally behind his back. Alton knelt above him, slowly increasing the pressure on Coben's arm. He looked impassive, detached, almost lackadaisical. Rin clenched at the railing.
When did he...
"He's Alton Trengzin," Raban said,
as if this were explanation enough.
"Yield!"
Coben shouted.
"Yield, damn it!"
"Break,"
said Sonnen, yawning.
"Alton wins. Next."
Alton released Coben and offered him a hand. Coben let Alton hoist him to his feet, then shook Alton's hand once he stood up. Coben took his defeat with good grace. There was no shame, it seemed, in being defeated by Alton Trengzin in less than 3 seconds.
"That's it?" Rin asked.
"It's not over," Raban said. "Alton got a lot of challengers tonight."
The next contender was Kareel. Raban frowned, shaking his head.
"She shouldn't have been given permission for this match."
Rin found this appraisal unfair. Kareel, who was one of Jun's prized combat apprentices, had a reputation for viciousness. Kareel and Alton appeared matched in height and strength. Surely she could hold her own.
"Begin."
Kareel charged Alton immediately.
"Great tortoise,"
Rin murmured. She had trouble following as Kareel and Alton began trading blows in close combat. They matched multiple strikes and parries per second, dodging and ducking around each other like dance partners. A minute passed. Kareel flagged visibly. Her blows became sloppy, overextended. Droplets of sweat flew from her forehead every time she moved. But Alton was unfazed.
still moving with that same feline grace he had possessed since the beginning of the match.
"He's playing with her," said Rabban.
Rin couldn't take her eyes off Alton. His movements were dance-like, hypnotic. Every action bespoke sheer power. Not the hulking muscle that Coben had embodied, but a compact energy, as if at every moment Alton were a tightly coiled spring about to go off.
"He'll end it soon," Rabban predicted.
It was ultimately a game of cat and mouse. Alton had never been evenly matched with Kareel. He fought on another level entirely. He had acted the part of her mirror to humor her at first, and then to tire her out. Kareel's movements slowed with every passing second. And mockingly, Alton too slowed down his pace to match Kareel's rhythm. Finally, Kareel lunged desperately forward, trying to score a hit on Alton's midriff. Instead of blocking it, Alton jumped aside, ran up against the dirt wall of the ring, rebounded off the other side, and twisted in the air. His foot caught Kareel in the side of the head. She snapped backward. She was unconscious before Alton landed behind her, crouched like a cat.
"Tiger's tits," said Kitai. "Tiger's tits," Rabban agreed.
Two orange-banded medicine apprentices jumped immediately into the pit to lift Kareel out. A stretcher was already waiting by the side of the ring. Alton hung in the center of the pit, arms folded, waiting calmly for them to finish. Even as they carried Kareel out of the basement, another student climbed down the rope ladder.
"Three challengers in one night," Kitai said. "Is that normal?"
"Alton fights a lot," said Rabban. "Everyone wants to be the one who takes him down."
"Has that ever happened?" Rin asked.
Rabban just laughed. The third challenger turned his shaved head up to the lamplight, and Rin realized with a start that it was Toby, the apprentice from the tour.
"Good," Rin thought. "I hope Alton destroys him."
Toby introduced himself loudly, whipping up yells from his combat classmates. Alton picked at his sleeve and again said nothing. He might have rolled his eyes, but in the dim light Rin couldn't be sure.
"Begin,"
Sonnen said. Toby flexed his arms and sank back into a low crouch. Rather than forming fists with his hands, he curled his knobby fingers tightly as if wrapping them around an invisible ball. Alton tilted his head as if to say, "Well, come on." The match quickly lost its elegance. It was a knock-down, bloody-knuckled, no-holds-barred struggle. It was heavy-handed and abrupt, and full of brute, animalistic force. Nothing was off-limits. Toby clawed furiously at Alton's eyes. Alton ducked his head and slammed an elbow into Toby's chest. Toby staggered back, wheezing for air. Alton backhanded him across the head as if disciplining a child. Toby tumbled to the floor, then rebounded with a complicated flipping motion and barreled forward. Alton raised his fists in anticipation, but Toby threw himself at Alton's waist, pushing both of them back to the ground. Alton slammed backward onto the dirt floor. Toby pulled his right arm back and drove his clawed fingers into Alton's stomach. Alton's mouth opened in the shape of a soundless scream. Toby dug his fingers in deeper and twisted. Rin could see veins protruding from his lower arm. His face warped into a wolf's snarl. Alton convulsed under Toby's grip and coughed. Blood sprayed from his mouth. Rin's stomach roiled.
"Shit," Kitai kept saying. "Shit, shit, shit."
"That's Tiger Claws," said Rabban. "Toby's signature technique. Inherited arts. Alton won't be able to shit properly for a week."
Sonnen leaned forward.
"All right, break."
But then Alton wrapped his free hand around Toby's neck and jammed Toby's face down into his own forehead. Once. Twice. Toby's grip went slack. Alton flung Toby off and lunged forward.
Half a second later, their positions were reversed. Toby lay inert on the ground as Alton kneeled atop him, hands pressed firmly around his neck. Toby tapped frantically at Alton's arm. Alton flung Toby away from him in disdain. He glanced at Master Sonnen as if awaiting further instructions. Sonnen shrugged.
That's the match.
Rin let out a breath she hadn't known she was holding. The medicine apprentices jumped into the ring and hauled Toby up. He moaned. Blood streamed from his nose. Alton hung back, leaning against the dirt wall. He looked bored, disinterested, as if his stomach weren't twisted into a sickening knot, as if he had never been touched at all. Blood dripped down his chin. Rin watched, partly in fascination and partly in horror, as Alton's tongue snaked out and licked the blood from his upper lip. Alton closed his eyes for a long time, and then tilted his head up and exhaled slowly through his mouth. Rabban grinned when he saw their expressions.
Makes sense now.
That was...
Kitai flapped his hands.
Ow! Ow!
Doesn't he feel pain?
Rin demanded.
He's not human.
He's not, said Rabban. He's a Spearly.
The next day at lunch, all any of the first years could talk about was Alton. The entire class had fallen in love with him, to some extent, but Kitai especially was besotted with him.
The way he moves, it's just...
Kitai waved his arms in the air, at a loss for words.
He doesn't talk much, does he?
Han said.
Wouldn't even introduce himself. Prick.
He doesn't need to introduce himself.
Kitai scoffed.
Everyone knows who he is.
Strong and mysterious,
Venka said dreamily. She and Nyang giggled.
Maybe he doesn't know how to talk,
Nedja suggested.
You know how the Spearlies were. Wild and bloodthirsty. Hardly knew what to do with themselves unless they'd been given orders.
The Spearlies weren't idiots,
Nyang protested.
They were primitive, scarcely more intelligent than children,
Nedja insisted.
I heard that they're more closely related to monkeys than human beings. Their brains are smaller. Did you know they didn't even have a written language before the Red Emperor? They're good at fighting, but not much else.
Several of their classmates nodded as if this made sense, but Rin found it hard to believe that someone who fought with such graceful precision as Alton could possibly have the cognitive ability of a monkey. Since arriving in Sinigard, she'd come to learn what it was like to be presumed stupid because of the shade of her skin. It rankled her. She wondered if Alton suffered the same.
You heard wrong. Alton's not stupid,
Rabban said.
Best student in our class. Possibly in the entire academy. Irja says he's never had such a brilliant apprentice.
I heard he's a shoo-in for command when he graduates,
said Han.
I heard he's doped up,
Nedja said. He was clearly unused to not being the center of attention. He seemed determined to undermine Alton's credibility in any way possible.
He's on opium. You can see it in his eyes. They're bloodshot all the time.
He's got red eyes because he's Spearly, you idiot,
Kitai said.
All the Spearlies had crimson eyes.
No, they didn't, said Nyang.
Only the warriors. Well, Alton's clearly a warrior, and his eyes are red in the iris,
Kitai said.
Not the veins. He's not an addict.
Nedja's lip curled.
Spend a lot of time staring at Alton's eyes, do you?
Kitai blushed.
You haven't heard the other apprentices talk.
Nedja continued smugly, like he was privy to special information that they weren't.
Alton is an addict. I heard Irja gives him poppy every time he wins. That's why he fights so hard. Opium addicts will do anything.
That's absurd, said Rin. You have no idea what you're talking about.
She knew what addiction looked like. Opium smokers were yellowed, useless sacks of flesh. They did not fight like Alton did. They did not move like Alton did. They were not perfect, lethal animals of graceful beauty. Great
tortoise, she realized. I'm just as obsessed with him myself.
6 months after the non-aggression pact was signed, Empress Su Daji formally banned the possession and use of all psychoactive substances within Nikon's borders, and instituted a series of harshly retributive punishments in an attempt to wipe out illegal drug use. Of course, black markets in opium continue to thrive in many provinces, provoking debates over the efficiency of such policies.
Master Yim looked up at his class. They were invariably twitching, scratching in their booklets, or staring out the window.
Am I lecturing to a graveyard?
Kitai raised his hand.
Can we talk about Spear?
What?
Yim furrowed his brow.
Spear doesn't have anything to do with what we're... Ah.
He sighed.
You've just met Trengzin, haven't you?
He was awesome,
Han said fervently to nods of agreement. Yim looked exasperated.
Every year,
he muttered.
Every year. Fine.
He tossed his lecture notes aside.
You want to talk about Spear? We'll talk about Spear.
The class was now paying rapt attention. Yim rolled his eyes as he shuffled through a thick stack of maps in his desk drawer.
Why was Spear bombed?
Kitai asked with impatience.
First things first, said Yim.
He flipped through several sheets of parchment until he found what he was looking for. A wrinkly map of Spear in the southern Nikon border.
I don't tolerate hasty historiography,
he said as he tacked it up on the board.
We'll start with appropriate political context. Spear became a Nikara colony during the Red Emperor's reign. Who can tell me about Spear's annexation?
Rin thought that annexation was a light way to put it. The truth was hardly so clinical. Centuries ago, the Red Emperor had taken the island by storm and forced the Spearlies into military service, turning the island warriors into the most feared contingent in the militia, until the Second Poppy War wiped them out. Neja raised his hand.
Spear was annexed under Maiden and Tirza, the last warrior queen of Spear. The old Nikata Empire asked her to give up her throne and pay tribute to Sinigard. Tirza agreed. Mostly because she was in love with the Red Emperor or something, but she was opposed by the Spearly Council. Legend has it that Tirza stabbed herself in desperation, and that final act convinced the Spearly Council of her passion for Nikon.
The room was silent for a moment.
That, Kitai mumbled, is the dumbest story I've ever heard.
Why would she kill herself? Rin asked out loud. Wouldn't she have been more useful alive to argue her case? Neja shrugged.
Reasons why women shouldn't be in charge of small islands.
This provoked a hubbub of responses. Yim silenced them with a raised hand.
It was not that simple. Legend, of course, has blurred the facts. The tale of Tirza and the Red Emperor is a love story, not a historical anecdote.
Venka raised her hand.
I heard the Red Emperor betrayed her. He promised he wouldn't invade Spear, but went back on his word.
Yim shrugged.
It's a popular theory. The Red Emperor was famed for his ruthlessness. A betrayal of that sort would not have been out of character. The truth is, we don't know why Tirza died, or if anyone killed her. We know only that she did die. Spear's tradition of warrior monarchs was discontinued, and the isle became annexed to the Empire until the Second Poppy War. Now, economically, Spear hardly pulled its weight as a colony. The island exported almost nothing of use to the Empire but soldiers. There is evidence that the Spearlies may not even have been aware of agriculture. Before the civilizing influence of the Red Emperor's envoys, the Spearlies were a primitive people who practiced vulgar and barbaric rituals. They had very little to offer culturally or technologically. In fact, they seemed centuries behind the rest of the world. Militarily, however, the Spearlies were worth their weight in gold.
Rin raised her hand.
Were the Spearlies really fire shamans?
Muted snickers sounded around the classroom, and Rin immediately regretted speaking. Yim looked amazed.
They still believe in shamans down in Takani?
Rin's cheeks felt hot. She had grown up hearing stories upon stories about Spear. Everyone in Takani was morbidly obsessed with the Empire's frenzied warrior force and their supposed supernatural abilities. Rin knew better than to take the stories for the truth, but she'd still been curious. But she had spoken without thinking. Of course the myths that had enthralled her in Takani only sounded backward and provincial here in the capital.
No, I mean, I don't... Rin stammered. It's just something I read. I was just wondering...
Don't mind her,
Naja said.
Takani still thinks we lost the Poppy Wars.
More snickers. Naja leaned back. Smug.
But the Spearlies had some weird abilities, right?
Kitai swiftly came to Rin's defense.
Why else would Mugen target Spear? Because it's a convenient target,
Naja said.
Smack dab between the Federation Archipelago and Snake Province. Why not?
That makes no sense.
Kitai shook his head.
From what I've read, Spear was an island of little to no strategic value. It's not even useful as a naval base. The Federation would be better off sailing directly over the narrow strait to Kirtiline. Mugen would only have cared about Spear if the Spearlies could do something that terrified them.
The Spearlies were terrifying,
Naja said.
Primitive, drug-loving freaks. Who wouldn't want them gone?
Rin couldn't believe Naja could be so terribly crass in describing a tragic massacre, and was amazed when Yim nodded in agreement.
The Spearlies were a barbaric, war-obsessed race,
he said.
They trained their children for battle as soon as they could walk. For centuries, they subsisted by regularly raiding Nakata coastal villages, because they had no agriculture of their own. Now, the rumors of shamanism probably have more to do with their religion. Historians believe they had bizarre rituals in which they pledged themselves to their god, the Vermilion Phoenix of the South. But that was only ever a ritual, not a martial ability.
The Spearly affinity for fire is well documented, though, said Kitai. I've read the war reports. There are more than a few generals, Nikata and Federation alike, who thought the Spearlies could manipulate fire at will.
Oh, myths,
Yim said dismissively.
The Spearly ability to manipulate fire was a ruse used to terrify their enemies. It probably originated from their use of flaming weapons in nighttime raids. But most scholars today agree that the Spearly battle prowess is entirely a product of their social conditioning and harsh environment.
So why couldn't our army copy them? Rin asked. If the Spearly warriors were really so powerful, why couldn't we emulate their tactics? Why do we have to enslave them?
Spear was a tributary, not a slave colony,
Yim said impatiently.
And we could recreate their training programs, but again, their methods were barbaric. The way June tells it, you're struggling with general training enough as it is. You'd hardly want to undergo the Spearly regimen.
What about Alton?
Kitai pressed.
He didn't grow up on Spear. He was trained at Synegard.
Have you ever seen Alton summon fire at will?
Of course not, but
has the very sight of him addled your minds?
Yim demanded.
Let me be perfectly clear. There are no shamans. There are no more Spearlies. Alton is human just like the rest of you. He possesses no magic, no divine ability. He fights well because he's been training since he could walk. Alton is the last scion of a dead race. If the Spearlies prayed to their god, it clearly didn't save them.
Their obsession with Alton wasn't entirely wasted in their lessons, though. After witnessing the apprentices' matches, the first years redoubled their efforts in June's class. They wanted to become graceful, lethal fighters like Alton. But June remained a meticulous coach.
He refused to teach them the flashy techniques they'd seen in the ring until they had thoroughly mastered their fundamentals.
"If you attempted Toby's tiger claws now, you couldn't kill a rabbit,"
he sneered.
"He'd just as quickly break your own fingers. It'll be months before you can channel the ki that sort of technique requires."
At least he had finally bored of drilling them in formation. Their class was now handling their staves with reasonable competence. At least, the accidental injuries were minimal. Near the end of class one day, Jun lined them up in rows and ordered them to spar.
"Responsibly,"
he emphasized.
"Half speed if you must. I have no patience for idiotic injuries. Drill on the strikes and parries that you've practiced in the form."
Rin found herself standing across from Nadja. Of course she was. He shot her a nasty smile. She wondered, briefly, how they could possibly finish the match without harming each other.
"On my count,"
said Jun.
"One, two."
Nadja launched himself forward. The force behind his blow stunned her. She barely got her staff up over her head in time to block a swing that would have knocked her out cold. The impact sent tremors through her arms. But Nadja continued to advance, ignoring Jun's instructions completely. He swung his staff with savage abandon, but also with startlingly good aim. Rin wielded her weapon clumsily. The staff was still awkward in her arms, nothing like the spinning blur in Nadja's hands. She could barely keep her grip on it. Twice it almost spun out of her grasp. Nadja landed far more hits than she blocked. The first two, elbow strike, upper thigh strike, hurt. Then Nadja landed so many that she couldn't feel them anymore. She had been wrong about him. He had been showing off earlier, but his command of martial arts was prodigious and real. Last time they'd fought, he'd gotten cocky. Her lucky blow had been a fluke. He was not being cocky now. His staff connected with her kneecap with a sickening crunch. Rin's eyes bulged. She crumpled to the ground. Nadja wasn't even bothering with his staff anymore. He kicked at her while she was still down, each blow more vicious than the last.
"That's the difference between you and me," muttered Nadja. "I've trained for this my entire life. You don't get to just stroll in here and embarrass me. You understand? You're nothing."
"He's going to kill me. He's actually going to kill me." Enough with the staff. She couldn't defend herself with a weapon she didn't know how to use. She dropped the staff and lunged upward to tackle Nadja around the waist. Nadja dropped his staff and tripped over backward. She landed on top of him. He swung at her face. She forced a palm into his nose. They pummeled furiously at each other, a chaotic tangle of limbs. Then something yanked hard at her collar, cutting off her airflow. Jun pried them apart in an impressive display of strength, held them suspended in the air for a minute, then flung them both to the ground.
"What part of block and parry was unclear?"
he growled.
"She started it,"
Nadja said quickly. He rolled to a sitting position and pointed at Rin.
"She dropped her!"
"I know what I saw,"
Jun snapped.
"And I saw you rolling around the floor like imbeciles. If I enjoyed training animals, I would be in the psych. Shall I put in a word?"
Nadja cast his eyes down.
"No, sir."
"Put your weapon away and leave my class. You're suspended for a week."
"Yes, sir."
Nadja rose to his feet, tossed his staff at the weapons rack, and stalked off. Jun then turned his attention to Rin. Blood dripped down her face, streaming from her nose, trickling down her forehead. She wiped clumsily at her chin, too nervous to meet June's eyes. He loomed above her.
"You, get up."
She struggled to her feet. Her knees screamed in protest.
"Get that pathetic look off your face. You won't receive any sympathy from me."
She didn't expect his sympathy, but neither was she expecting what came next.
"That was the most miserable display I've seen from a student since I left the militia,"
Jun said.
"Your fundamentals are horrific. You move like a paraplegic." What did I just witness? Have you been asleep for the past month?
He moved too fast. I couldn't keep up. I don't have years of training like he does.
Even as the words came to her mind, they sounded like the pathetic excuses they were. She opened her mouth and closed it, too stunned to respond.
I hate students like you,
Jun continued relentlessly. The sounds of staves clashing against one another had long died away. The entire class was listening.
You skip into synagogue from your little village, thinking that this is it. You've made it. You're going to make Mommy and Daddy proud. Maybe you were the smartest kid in your village. Maybe you were the best test taker your tutor has ever seen. But guess what? It takes more than memorizing a few classics to be a martial artist. Every year we get someone like you. Some country bumpkin who thinks that just because they were good at taking some test, they deserve my time and attention. Understand this, Southerner. The exam proves nothing. Discipline and competence. Those are the only things that matter at this school. That boy,
Jun jerked his thumb in the direction Naja had gone,
may be an ass, but he has the makings of a commander in him. You, on the other hand, are just peasant trash.
The entire class was staring at her now. Kitai's eyes were wide with sympathy. Even Venka looked stunned. Rin's ears rang, drowning out June's words. She felt so small. She felt as if she might crumble into dust.
Don't let me cry.
Her eyes throbbed from the pressure of forcing back her tears.
Please don't let me cry.
I do not tolerate troublemakers in my class,
June said.
I do not have the happy privilege to expel you, but as combat master I can do this. From now on you are banned from the practice facilities. You do not touch the weapons rack. You do not train in the studio during off hours. You do not set foot in here while I am teaching a class. You do not ask older students to teach you. I don't need you causing any more trouble in my studio. Now get out of my sight.
Chapter 5 Rin stumbled out the courtyard door. June's words echoed over and over in her head. She was suddenly dizzy. Her legs wobbled and her vision went temporarily black. She slid down against the stone wall, hugging her knees to her chest while blood pumped furiously in her ears. Then the pressure in her chest bubbled up and she cried for the first time since orientation, sobbing with her face pressed into her hands so that no one could hear. She cried from the pain. She cried from the embarrassment. But mostly she cried because those 2 long years of studying for the Kaju hadn't meant a thing. She was years behind her peers at Synagard. She had no martial arts experience, much less an inherited art, even one that looked as stupid as Naja's. She hadn't trained since childhood, like Venka. She wasn't brilliant, didn't have an eidetic memory like Kitai. And the worst thing was, now she had no way to make up for it. Without June's tutelage, frustrating though it was, Rin knew she didn't have a chance of making it past the trials. No master would choose to take on an apprentice who couldn't fight. Synagard was primarily a military academy. If she couldn't hold her own on the battlefield, then what was the point? June's punishment was as good as an expulsion. She was done. It was over. She'd be back in Takani within a year.
But Naja attacked first.
The more she considered this, the faster her despair crystallized into anger. Naja had tried to kill her. She had acted only in self-defense. Why had she been thrown out of the class, when Naja had gotten off with little more than a slap on the wrist? But it was so clear why.
Najah was a Sinigardian noble, the son of a warlord, and she was a country girl with no connections and no status. Expelling Najah would have been troublesome and politically contentious. He mattered.